Hey everybody, this is another podcast here from Cass. Not another wrestling one. I would love to do more wrestling podcasts, and I will in the future most definitely, but I just haven't been able to do the research to make the notes to be able to put together a podcast. And I've just been dying to do another podcast, even though I've been unable to do that. But I have come up with something. Before I say what it is, though, you'll also notice my mic is finally back, so better quality. If I can get the files, this may also open up with some epic sound effects. I don't know, but here we go. What this is my... I don't know if... For a second, I was thinking, did I want to divulge this backstory? But I've said it before, so fucking whatever. My psychologist recommended to me Jordan Peterson's book, and my mom went out and bought it for me, and this was a while back, and I have not read this. I decided a very first impression reading of this would be very fun. Depending on how long the chapters are, I might do chapter by chapter, but if they're very big chapters, then I'll just split it up whenever. But anyhow, let's look at this. So Jordan B. Peterson. We're living in the reality where Jordan Peterson didn't die sadly and then just became washed up, when in another universe he would have had a heroic death, as you can tell by the B. But don't know if I said the title, but I'll say it again. 12 Rules for Life. Very minimalist cover. It's just white. It's got his name up the top. Got 12 Rules for Life. Oh, I missed the subtitle here. An Antidote to Chaos. Ooh. And around that are little arrows. I don't know why, what they're pointing to. And this is the number one international bestseller. Because it's... I mean, it's more or less a self-help book. So it's not really surprising that this got really big, especially with the sort of association with the old, right? But anyways, let's go back to the back of the book here. Look at the... What do you call this again? The... blurb? Looking at the blurb here, so, the most influential public, okay, that probably sounded like a phone-in laugh, but that actually made me laugh. The most influential public intellectual in the Western world right now. Ooh, already bringing out the fucking West bullshit over here, Western culture, and that's, by the New York Times. Then we have, Peterson can take the most... I nearly went for a laugh there again. Peterson can take the most difficult ideas and make them entertaining. He is fast... He is fast becoming the closest that academia has to a rock star. Shut the fuck up. That's The Observer. You have nothing to lose but your own misery, says the Toronto Star. Very ominous. And The Guardian, one of the most eclectic and stimulating public intellectuals at large today, fearless and impassioned. And that's probably my favorite out of all the quotes here, because it's, you know, kind of buzzwordy, but at least it's not sort of giving good old Jordan a fucking blowjob here. But down below we have a little sort of mini biography. Jordan B. Peterson's a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto. He's taught mythology to lawyers, doctors, and business people. Why do they need to know mythology? Consulted for the UN Secretary General and helped his clinical clients manage depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, and anxiety. His book, Maps of Meaning, which I won't get too much into, I've heard loosely of it, I've seen things from it, all I know is that there are nonsensical diagrams, which I hope we can see in this book, which I will describe to you, as this is a podcast, and I can't show you the images. But anyhow, revolutionized the psychology of religion, and I don't know what Jordan Peterson's religion is. I'm pretty sure he's, like, an atheist. I don't know. When you're an atheist, talking about religion's a bit of a shaky thing. And especially someone like Jordan Peterson revolutionizing the psychology of religion, I don't know about that. But anyways, and while a professor at Harvard University, he was nominated for the prestigious, and I haven't peeled the sticker off here, so it's blocking this, the prestigious Levinson Teaching Prize. Okay, there you go. Jesus Christ, I was looking at the sticker here. This cost $35. One more thing before we dive into this. It's a sort of paperback. It feels a bit weird. It's not a hardcover. Paperback feels weird and papery, obviously. Now, anyways, I just looked over there, see if I have a bit of water, because my throat's starting to get a little... Just let me hold on a second. Got a nice amount of water. If need be, I'll just stop recording and come back later. But anyways, let's actually open this book up. We open with this little page here. And also, before I actually start reading the contents of this, think of this as sort of like a Mystery Science Theater 3000. They, like, shat on movies. This is me shitting on a book. Is it legal? Probably not. I don't give a shit. If I need to, I'll just remake this and look at snippets. But, let's just hope this doesn't get taken down or whatever. So, like I said, we start off with a little page here. And it has in bold, "What are the most valuable things that everyone should know?" Probably how to live. I don't know how to phrase it. Like, how to survive in this world, I imagine. So let's see what they say. Acclaimed clinical psychologist Jordan Peterson has reshaped the modern understanding of personality. What? What do you mean? Personality? Are we talking like the jocks and the nerds, or like what the we're gonna find out. And personality, and is one of the world's most influential public thinkers, with his lectures on topics from the Bible to romantic relationships. Hey, I don't know if he knows about that. To mythology, drawing tens of millions of viewers in an era of unprecedented change and polarizing politics. Ooh. Oh, by the way, speaking of. I haven't read this, like I said, but I did look at the glossary, once, just to see. And yes, lobsters and neo-Marxism is mentioned in this book, so look forward to that. His frank and refreshing message about value of individual responsibility and ancient wisdom has resonated around the world. In this book, he provides 12 profound and practical principles for how to live a meaningful life, from setting your house in order... Clean your house, before criticizing others, to... That was a whole sentence? Setting your house in order before criticizing others. I mean, there are certain things... Like, you shouldn't be able to criticize others before you have certain things in check, but I don't know if you need, like, the tidiest fucking house to be able to do that. Not saying you should be a hoarder, but, you know. But anyways, to comparing yourself to who you were yesterday... Not someone else today. I don't think that's a huge point. I think a lot of people kind of grab onto that. Like, people learn that without having to read this book. But anyways, happiness is a pointless goal. He shows us. Instead, we must search for meaning, not for its own... I don't know. I mean, happiness is fleeting, yes, but I don't know if you should... I'm not gonna fucking, even though this is a sort of philosophy thing, I'm not gonna fucking go into the semantics of the meaning of life, but it has different meanings to everyone. I'm not getting into it. Just make that conclusion yourself, listener. Instead, meaning, not for its own sake, but as a defense against the suffering that is intrinsic to our existence. Again, like, I feel that's another thing that people sort of realize when they grow up, like, you have a sort of existential dread, and not everyone suffers from depression, but I'm sure everyone has a sort of, you know, sort of moment where they're like, well, shit, I've got a life ahead of me, what do I want to do with my life, the fucking afterlife, or, like, if I die, I'm gonna be nothing. A lot of people sort of get their meaning to that, and, yeah, there can be, help required to reach that sort of understanding, but I don't think you need a $35 fucking book. But anyways, drawing on vivid examples from his clinical practice and personal life, and lessons from humanity's oldest myths and stories, ooh boy, time to make some meaningless links and pretend they mean things. 12 Rules for Life offers an antidote to the chaos in our lives, eternal truths applied to our modern problems. Brilliant. There's a fucking oh my god. I didn't believe... I'm sorry. I just had a 404 moment in my brain. I'm losing it. I'm straight up losing it. So, there's a foreword by Norman Doidge. I don't know who he is, but he's probably not someone great considering we have illustrations by Ethan Van Sciver. Now, for those of you who aren't savvy in the comic book world, Ethan Van Sciver, I don't know if it's Sciver or Sciver, I'm just going to say Sciver. Ethan Van Sciver worked, I don't know if he worked for Marvel, but he worked a lot for DC, known for Green Lantern. Pretty good artist, but I don't know if he got fired for his political opinions, but he doesn't work for DC anymore, and he's very alt-right, and he's, I hope this isn't, like, sort of ableist of me to say, but he's kind of a fucking nut job, quite frankly. He bought, like, he loves to own the SJWs. He bought a bunch of figures of the character Rose from the 8th Star Wars movie off the shelf. I think he was like, hey, look, they're at a discount price because no one wants them. And he, like, cut their heads off. He's like a fucking weirdo. Ethan Van Sciver. And he made his own Kickstarter. He's just an alt-right wacko. That's all I need to say about him, quite frankly. Okay, so then we have table of contents. So yeah, it looks like each of these chapters is about 30 pages long, so I might be able to do one podcast per chapter, but we'll see. Foreword. Rules? More rules? Really? Isn't life complicated enough, restricting enough, without abstract rules that don't take our unique individual situations into account? This is something that, yeah, actually I can agree on. I hate structure. I love to live very freely. But at the same time, I think there's a sort of midpoint you can figure out that you don't really need this sort of... I'm not going to call it bullshit yet. I'm going to give Jordan Peterson the benefit of the doubt because I haven't read this yet. But I don't feel like you need to entirely structure your life to be able to be successful or have meaning in it, but that's just my opinion. But anyways, just lost where I was reading up to. And given that our brains are plastic, okay, I would have likened it to memory foam mattresses, but and develop differently based on our life experiences. Okay, I don't know a lot about plastic, but is that a whole thing, that plastic develops differently? I would have likened it... Again, I know I would have just said memory foam, but if we're talking about growing differently, I would have likened it to, like, different types of plants. It might be a little nitpick, sorry if I'm overly critical. But anyways, moving on, why even expect that a few rules might be helpful to us at all? I mean, because there are customs in life that we adhere to, and even if some of them are kind of bullshit, that some things... I'm bad at phrasing my point, so I apologize if I ever do get on these big tangents. But, like, there are things in life, like, 3 meals a day, that keeps you afloat. We all do that, but we don't lose our fucking individualism over it. People don't clamor for rules, even in the Bible, as when Moses comes down the mountain after a long absence, bearing the tablets inscribed with 10 commandments, and finds the children of Israel in revelry. They'd been Pharaoh's slaves and subject to his tyrannical regulations for 400 years, and after that, Moses subjected them to the harsh desert wilderness for another 40 years to purify them of their slavishness. Now, free at last, they're unbridled, and have lost control as they dance wildly around an idol, a golden calf displaying all manner of corporeal corruption. I've got some good news, and I've got some bad news, the Lord give yells to them. What do you want first? The good news, the hedonist reply. Again, hedonism, I don't think, is an inherently bad thing. I think we will get into politics here, as we probably will be. And again, another disclaimer, I do not pretend to know, like, I'm very new to the sort of politics thing. So I may say some foolish things. I will gladly allow the listener to make their own decisions. And even if you want, message me and sort of say, hey, you're right about this, hey, you're wrong about this, if you want to. But anyways, I don't think hedonism is really a bad thing. And obviously, like, yeah, sins are disguised as things that are, like, things that we like, for example, lust. You know, we're all sexual on the inside. But at the same time, to a certain extent, which I guess you could make an excuse for all the sins, but I still think in general, hedonism is sort of disregarded a lot due to the capitalist world we live in. And this could just be me wildly speculating, but, you know, people don't like you having fun. Labor is hard. Hard work, that's what's valued. I feel like hedonism is shat on very easily. But like I said, not necessarily a bad thing. But continuing on, I got him from 15 commandments down to 10. Hallelujah cries in the unruly crowd, and the bad adultery is still in. Ha 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 ha. That kind of sounded like a Jordan Peterson impression, Jesus. So rules there will be, but please not too many. We are ambivalent about rules, even when we know they're good for us. If we're spirited souls, if we have character, rules seem restrictive, an affront to our sense of agency and our pride in working out our own lives. Why should we be judged according to another's rule? And judged we are. After all, God didn't give Moses the 10 suggestions. He gave commandments. And if I'm a free agent, my first reaction to a command might just be that nobody, not even God, tells me what to do, even if it's good for me. But the story of the golden calf is to remind us that without rules, we quickly become slaves to our passions. And there's nothing freeing about that. I think I already discussed this sort of thing, like, you don't have to be extreme, so I'll just continue on. And the story suggests something more. Unchaperoned and left to our own untortured judgment, we are quick to aim low and worship qualities that are beneath us. In this case, an artificial animal that brings us our own animal instincts in a completely unregulated way. The old Hebrew story makes it clear how the ancients felt about our prospects for civilized behavior in the absence of rules that seek to elevate our gaze and raise our standards. One neat thing about the Bible story... I just like this preface as if, like, the rest of this is shit, but this... is that it doesn't simply list its rules as lawyers or legislators or administrators might. It embeds them in a dramatic tale that illustrates why we need them, thereby making them easier to understand. Similarly, in this book, Jordan Peterson is already likening himself to fucking God delivering the Ten Commandments. The 12 rules for life are just as important as the Ten Commandments. Fucking hell, Jordan. Talk about self-aggrandizing. Professor Peterson doesn't just propose his 12 rules, he tells stories too, bringing to bear his knowledge of many fields as he illustrates and explains why the best rules do not ultimately restrict us, but instead facilitate our goals and make for fuller, freer lives. Again, I don't entirely agree there. Personally, I think you can be a lot freer, but again, I'm not gonna rag on the same fucking things over and over again. The first time I met Jordan Peterson was on September 12, 2004, at the home of two mutual friends, TV producer Wodek Semsberg, sorry if I pronounced that wrong, and medical internist Estera Bekia, again, sorry if I pronounced that wrong. It was Wodek's birthday party. Wodek and Estera are Polish emigres. I'm just going to not apologize after every word, but just, again, another disclaimer, if there are large words or like foreign words like this, I'm probably going to get them wrong. Who grew up within the Soviet Empire, where it was understood that many topics were off-limits, and that casually questioning certain social arrangements and philosophical ideas, not to mention the regime itself, could mean big trouble. But now, host and hostess luxuriated in easygoing, honest talk, by having elegant parties devoted to the pleasure of saying what you really thought, and hearing others do the same in an uninhibited give-and-take. Here, the rule was speak your mind. If the conversation turned to politics, people of different political persuasions spoke to each other, indeed looked forward to it, in a manner that is increasingly rare. Okay, there's a lot of subtle sort of shitting on modern politics here, but basically, the underlying thing here is that people don't talk about politics nowadays, they get too triggered. And again, I might be reading a bit too much into this, but this is what I see here, and I have to disagree. Just when you're going into a political conversation, you're not trying to shit on the other person. You want to have a good faith argument but a lot of people go in with bad faith arguments. And I'm not saying it's exclusive to the right that they have bad faith arguments, but you do see a lot of sort of bad faith arguments to dispel leftists, while I argue leftists are more sort of, you know, open to discussion and the idea of having their viewpoint changed, while right wingers are more sort of really defensive of the old guard, as it were. Sometimes Wardick's own opinions or truth exploded out of him, as did his laugh. Then he'd hug whoever made him laugh or provoked him to speak his mind with greater intensity than even he might have intended. This was the best part of the parties, and this frankness and his warm embraces made it worth provoking him. Meanwhile, Estera's voice lilted across the room on a very precise path towards its intended listener. Truth explosions didn't make the atmosphere any less easygoing for company. They made for more truth explosions, liberating us and more laughs, and making the whole evening more pleasant. Because with depressing Eastern Europeans, like the Zemberg big ears, you always knew with what and with whom you were dealing, and that frankness was enlivening. Again, I feel sort of undertones of shitting on, you know, be more like these people, but that could just be me. Honneur de Balzac. I am very bad. That was a terrible accent, as you can tell, Jesus. The novelist once described the balls and parties in his native France, observing that what appeared to be a single party was always really two. In the first hours, the gathering was suffused with bored people posing and posturing, and attendees who came to meet, perhaps, one special person who would confirm them in their beauty and status. Then, only in the very late hours, after more of the guests had left, would be the second party, the real party, begin. Here the conversation was shared by each person present, and open-hearted laughter replaced the starchy airs. I have to disagree. Party is in two parts, yes. There is that very first part, but the second part is often everyone in a drunken stupor sitting around in their own misery. But anyways, at Esther and Rodex parties, this kind of wee hours of the morning disclosure and intimacy often began as soon as we entered the room. Wodek is a silver-haired, lion-maned hunter, always on the lookout for potential public intellectuals who knows how to spot people who can really talk in front of a TV camera and who look authentic because they are. The camera picks up on that. He often invites such people to the salons. That day, Wodek brought a psychology professor from my own University of Toronto who fit the bill. Intellect and emotion in tandem. Wodek was the first to put Jordan Peterson in front of a... Hold on, I just skipped a page in flicking over. A camera, and thought of him as a teacher in search of students, because he was always ready to explain. And it helped that he liked the camera, and the camera liked him back. Yes, I'm sure Jordan Peterson loves the camera. And the camera liked him back. Again, Jesus, this is very self-aggrandizing, even though this is a foreword from a friend. Like I said, with the blurb and all the quotes on the back, a lot of fucking sort of blowjobs going on here, in my opinion. That afternoon, there was a large table set outside in Zemberg Bakir's garden. Around it gathered the unusual collection of lips, or the usual collection, rather, of lips and ears and loquacious virtuosos. We seemed, however, to be plagued by a buzzing paparazzi of bees, and here was this new fellow at the table with an Albertan accent. I'm not familiar with Canada. Is that a thing? In cowboy boots, who was ignoring them and kept on talking. The paragon of fashion, Jordan Peterson is. He kept talking while the rest of us were playing musical chairs. This paints a picture. Jordan Peterson sitting at a party, everyone trying to have fun, and he just won't shut the fuck up. Anyways, to keep away from the pests, he's also trying to remain at the table because this new addition to our gatherings was so interesting. He had this odd habit of speaking about the deepest questions. He's very deep, dude. To whoever was at the table. Most of them new acquaintances. As though he were just making small talk. Or if he did do small talk, the interval between, how do you know Wodick and Estera, or I was a beekeeper once, so I'm used to them, and more serious topics would be nanoseconds. One might hear such questions discussed at parties where professors and professionals gather, but usually the conversation would remain between two specialists in this topic off in a corner, or if shared with the whole group, it was not without someone preening. But this Peterson, though a Rudite, didn't come across as a pedant. He had the enthusiasm of a kid who had just learned something new and had to share it. as in, like, okay, again, I've got something here that I want to say, I don't know how to phrase it. When a kid just learns something and wants to share it, a lot of the time it's kind of a diluted point and isn't really correct, which I imagine might fit the bill for Peterson. We'll see. He seemed to be assuming, as a child would, before learning how dulled adults can become, that if he thought something was interesting, then so might others. There was something boyish in the cowboy. This sounds like a romance novel now. In his broaching of subjects, as though we had all grown up together in the same small town or family, and had all been thinking about the very same problems of human existence all along. Peterson really wasn't an eccentric. I know how to say that word, that was just a terrible. Eccentric. Okay, now it seems like I can't say the word. Eccentric. Eccentric. I'm having that, I forget what the very smart word for it is, but you know, you say a word, it doesn't sound right. But anyways, he had sufficient conventional chops, had been a Harvard professor, and a gentleman, as cowboys be. Can be. It would have been funny if it said, as cowboys be. Though he did say damn and bloody a lot in a rural 1950s kind of way. Wow. But everyone listened with fascination on their faces because he was, in fact, addressing questions of concern to everyone at the table. There was something freeing about being with a person so learned, yet speaking in such an unedited way. Again, this is just sounding like a romance novel. His thinking was motoric. It seemed he needed to think aloud, to use his motor cortex to think. But that motor also had to run fast to work properly, to get to liftoff. Not quite manic, but his idling speed revved high. Spirited thoughts were tumbling out, but unlike many academics who take the floor and hold it, if someone challenged or corrected him, he really seemed to like it. He didn't rear up a nay. He'd say, in a kind of folksy way, yeah, and bow his head involuntarily, wag it if he overlooked something, laughing at himself for overgeneralizing. Okay, again, I haven't delved into the sort of videos of Peterson for a while, but I don't know about that. I call that into question. Again, you, the viewer, make your own assumptions there, conclusions. He appreciated being shown another side of an issue, and it became clear that thinking through a problem was for him a dialogic, I don't know, process. One could not be struck by another unusual thing about him. For an egghead, Peterson was extremely practical. His examples were filled with applications to everyday life. Business management, how to make furniture, he made much of his own. Oh, Jesus, I just. Designing a simple house, making a room beautiful. Now an internet meme. Lovely. Or in another specific case related to education, creating. Sorry, I just gotta say, if that close-up was too loud, I apologize. I just felt it really needed emphasis. Creating an online writing project that kept minority students from dropping out of school by getting them to do a kind of psychoanalytic exercise on themselves. I'd like to hear more about this. This sounds a little in which they would free associate about their past, present, and future, now known as the self-authoring program. I was always fond of Midwestern prairie types. I swear to God, this is a romance novel. Who come from a farm where they learnt all about nature, or from a very small town, and who have worked with their hands to make things, spent long periods outside. Jordan Peterson is a real man's man. In the harsh elements, and often self-educated, and go to university against the odds. Yes, a real man's man indeed. I found them quite unlike the sophisticated but somewhat denatured urban counterparts, for whom higher education was preordained, and for that reason sometimes taken for granted, or thought of not as end in itself, but simply as a life stage in the service of career advancement. Give me a second, please. Sorry. These Westerners were different. Self-made, untitled, hands-on, neighborly, and less precious than many of their big city peers, who increasingly spend their lives indoors manipulating symbols on computers. Okay, I'm not gonna lie. from all this reading, I started to feel, not just my throat, I started to feel a little lightheaded, so if there was anything there I could have taken a rib on, it just went straight out my head, and I'm not gonna reread it, sorry. So again, you make your own conclusion there.
This cowboy psychologist seemed to care about thought only if it might, in some way, be helpful to someone.
We became friends. As a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst who loves literature, how long is this? My throat is starting to hurt, and this goes on for a while. Jesus Christ. Jesus. Okay. I'm going to stop at this paragraph, I think. We became friends as a psychiatrist. Sorry. Excuse me. I was drawn to him because here was a clinician who also had given himself a great books education, and who not only loved soulful Russian novels, philosophy, and ancient mythology, but who also seemed to treat them as his most treasured inheritance. But he also did illuminating statistical research on personality and temperament, and had studied neuroscience. Though trained as a behaviorist, he was powerfully drawn to psychoanalysis with its focus on dreams, archetypes, the persistence of childhood conflicts in the adult, and the role of defenses and rationalization in everyday life. He was also an outlier in being the only member of the research-oriented department of psychology at the University of Toronto who kept a clinical practice. Okay, so that's where I'm going to stop it for this episode. We're only in the foreword, and we're only like halfway through, if that. I'm sorry for cutting it short, but starting to get a bit of a sore throat here, among other things. I don't know if future episodes will be, well, I mean, I wouldn't say short, because this is half an hour itself, so I don't know if pacing is going to be a problem here, but regardless, in the future, feel free to look forward to more of these. I hope you liked this episode. Yeah, I don't know what else to say. See you later, alligator.